Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage Podcast. I'm Doug Berkey, Mitchell Institute's Executive Director. And today, we're going to talk about long-range strike with General Tim Rick, who's commander of Global Strike Command. And you're probably wondering where Slick is right now, and I'm happy to report he's at Kennedy Space Center as we speak, researching for some future episodes. So it's my pleasure to dive into this episode with you as a guest host. Now, when I refer to long-range strike, I'm talking about the ability to launch an aircraft that can reach anywhere on the planet, strike upwards of 80 separate targets on a single mission, and return home safe to regenerate and do it all over again. Now, other services and our allies don't have this capability, so it all comes down to U.S. Air Force bombers. And this matters a lot, because long-range strike is what empowers a broad range of options required by our nation's top leaders and operational-level commanders. You know, an adversary's ability to project hostile military power depends on what we call centers of gravity. These are the ends, ways, and means that tie to the essence of a military enterprise. No two enemy systems are alike, but there's some general centers of gravity, like leadership, command and control, weapons production, storage depots, transportation links, and fielded forces that normally comprise this list. And you've heard folks like General Horner and General Deptula talk about the specific centers of gravity and target sets that they identified and attacked during our Desert Storm episodes. So look at it this way. If you have a finite number of weapons, where will you get the best effect? And this is a big job, because an average theater level campaign, and I'm talking something like Iran or North Korea here, will normally have around 40 to 50,000 aim points. If we look at China or Russia, the number could be over 100,000. So commanders really need to seek options that will put the most firepower against the greatest number of targets in a rapid, precise fashion. And it's all about overwhelming an enemy's war-making enterprise and collapsing it. We don't want to give them the benefit of time to work alternate solutions. That's why strategies based upon the notion of gradualism are so ineffective. And joining me for this conversation is Mitchell Dean, General Dave Deptula, who's planned and led several combat operations. So, sir, thanks for being here.
Well, Doug, you bet. This is a topic that I wouldn't want to miss, because it's simply crucial to America's ability to fight and win our wars. Now, our adversaries know this, and it's why you see commanders deploy bombers when tensions are heightened in key regions. Our enemies get the message. They understand what bombers can do, and it reaffirms our commitment to our allies. Bombers are very powerful tools, and frankly, they're among America's most cost-effective weapon systems. And that doesn't even include the bomber's role in the nuclear triad, where it serves as the most flexible leg, providing nuclear deterrence. So I think you get the picture. Bombers are hugely important, but it's also an area where America needs to reinvest. Today, in its entirety, the United States military possesses a mere 140 bombers in its operational inventory. That's the smallest number going back to the founding of the United States Air Force. And by the way, it's not just the smallest number in the U.S. inventory. It's the smallest number because we are the only nation that possesses bombers. So it's the smallest number amongst all the Western powers. Like you said, Doug, the Air Force is the only service in the free world that operates bomber aircraft. And over half are the B-52, the youngest of which is 58 years old. We only have 20 stealth bombers, which possess the ability to penetrate enemy defenses and go after the most critical and highly defended targets. That's why the B-21, America's next generation stealth bomber, is so important. Now, Northrop Grumman's in the midst of building the very first aircraft, and I think it's safe to assume we'll see them enter the operational inventory in the middle back half of the 2020s. But it's a development that can't come soon enough.
Sir, thanks for that. Now, while I get the Air Force is the only service that has bombers, I also hear a lot about other branches pursuing long-range strike options these days. Could you explain that?
Sure, Doug. What's going on is a roles and missions thrash where many of the services are trying to prove their relevance in the wake of Afghanistan and Iraq. The calculus has changed a lot as we look at operations against top-tier competitors like China, and with budgets set to get tighter, some of the services, particularly the Army, are aggressively trying to grab mission that they think will help them become more relevant in our new national security strategy. And long-range strike is at the top of that list. And because the other services lack bombers, they're looking to develop long-range missiles. The problem is they're not doing, and that the leadership in the Department of Defense is not doing a cost per effect evaluation on a comparison between, you know, one-shot missiles and long-range reusable bombers. Many of the missiles that we're talking about cost double-digit millions of dollars per shot. And some types under consideration even border on a handful of them costing the equivalent of an F-35. There's no way that that is affordable given the volume of targets at play. Remember, missiles can't be reused and they require extensive logistics support to get them into a theater. The crews operating them also need to know where to aim, which drives a requirement for overhead imagery. Instead of relying on joint capabilities, the Army is looking at developing its own aircraft and space-based sensors that duplicates what the Air Force already provides. This flies in the face of what it means to be joint, with services working together to yield a better hold. It also sees them divert money from core responsibilities, in the Army's case, like providing for air-based defense and missile defense. There's a reason why services have core competencies and why roles and missions matter. And it's time to induce some discipline into the process. Finite dollars need to be directed toward programs that optimize combat options and capabilities across all the services, not just one.
Sir, I totally agree. So with that background on the table, let's welcome General Ray.
Well, General Ray, we really appreciate you being here today. And we have provided our audience with some basics behind bombers. But I'd like to start to have you discuss the mission from your perspective as the commander of Global Strike Command. Could you explain the unique value that bombers afford to our nation?
Well, Dave, I appreciate the chance to be here and talk to you guys. It's always good to do that. The things that have been said already are very good in leading up to this piece of it. I would just repeat the following kinds of thoughts. First of all, it's flexible, right? So when you watch what the bomber task forces are doing today, the ability to be just about anywhere in a number of hours and to do it very quickly and visibly is a huge piece of that. The payload that we can bring, the versatility that we can bring. I like to say it is the Allied bomber force. It's not just the U.S. bomber force. It's the only bomber force on the Western team. And it certainly becomes, both from a conventional and a nuclear standpoint, particularly in the nuclear standpoint, the version of extended deterrence that our partners and allies probably embraced first, if they had to go look at their own domestic audience and their own voters, they would say, yeah, the Americans have our back on this. But what we can bring with range, speed, and payload and flexibility and that touch point is probably one of the strongest things. And our ability to just keep reinventing what we can do with a bomber, it's classic air power.
Well, sir, from my understanding, the request for these aircraft from the combatant commands is quite high. Could you speak to us about how this demand signal has grown in recent years and what's driving it?
Well, as we start looking, away from the counterterrorism part of what we've been doing to, no kidding, the NDS and the great power competition, it becomes very clear the role that bombers play. When I get up every morning, I come to the office, I have my Intel read book. It's the PAC Indo-PACOM, it's the UCOM read book, it's the NORTHCOM read book, the STRATCOM read book, the Joint Staff read book. So I read all of those intel books because I need to understand what's happening everywhere in the world. And then I'm routinely on the phone with my air component teammates to really understand what they're dealing with. And what the bomber task forces have really proven is that you don't have to be static. In fact, if you're not, and you can come into and out of the theater, you're very effective. It's become incredibly helpful to a lot of folks. I get a lot of good feedback from particularly from the combatant commands and from those components. And part of their feedback is how deeply the partners and allies appreciate it. So they're in very high demand. And I think you just talk to the crews, their morale is through the roof. I now have the highest bomber air crew readiness in the history of the command, even in COVID. And that's part of how we're operating that really allows us to be much more capable, much more ready, very high demand.
General, I'd like to take a moment to talk about the past two decades of combat operations. Bombers kicked off nearly every campaign, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and so on and so forth. I certainly used them in the opening hours of Desert Storm, as well as Operation Enduring Freedom. These aircraft provide tremendous mission coverage across numerous areas, from going after strategic targets to close air support. Could you talk to the audience about how their utility has adapted and evolved? I mean, and if you look at how hard aircraft like the B-1 were in demand, that certainly reflects how our warfighters in combat theaters really valued their contributions.
Yeah, there's a couple of dimensions on that, Dave. We continue to work alongside our CAF teammates. And what I think one of the bigger helps is that over the years that, you know, we have been part of the CAF, we have, you know, been deeply involved in integration. You know, we as airmen do that better than anyone else from a multi-domain standpoint. And so it's the ability to continue to integrate effectively in anybody's plan that allows us to keep reinventing and thinking that part through. The advent of targeting pods, you know, on a bomber now for a direct attack and certainly for CAS has been something we picked up. And I remember where people thought we were crazy for trying to do that. But, you know, there's a few times where we get told we're crazy and then people act like, well, we should have been doing that all along. So, you know, bombers and CAS was a big argument back in the early days of OEF. And, you know, now it's an obvious requirement. But I think when we start looking at the list of things I can do versus the list of things that I have the people to do from weapons load crews or, you know, any of those kinds of things, there's a lot of missions that actually I could probably turn my hand to, like mining and a few other things that with more time and resources, I could be even more helpful to the commands. We talk a lot in the joint warfighting concepts about warfighting in the conflict side of things, but there's really either side of that is an important piece that we tend to miss. The far right edge of that, of course, is the nuclear integration with conventional resources and how we're going to have to do that since we've never fought a nuclear armed adversary in our history. But to the far, far left of that is the ability to compete, to show up in places like Prince Sultan Air Base and do a hot pit refueling with a two-ship of B-1s and to show we can come do that, to answer a cold call within 51 hours to be on the ramp at Al-Udeid or to go help the guys in Ascent or any of a number of things, the CONUS flights and how we can integrate. Those are just huge. And so as we think about the CAPES and the technologies that are coming and the ability to add them, I think that there's a whole lot more we can continue to do with this really pretty small force.
Sir, in a perfect world, we'd have a lot more bombers be able to forward deploy them around the globe on a permanent basis, you know, much like we do with fighters and other types. But with 140 aircraft, that clearly isn't possible. So to help work around this limitation, but still gain the benefits of forward presence, you and your team developed the Bomber Task Force concept. Could you talk to us about that? What are the specific effects you're trying to attain?
Well, like our CAF teammates, we wrote the version of Agile Combat Employment. So it's the bomber Agile Combat Employment. And how we would do as well the nuclear mission, where we would have to think about things differently. All of this is how we want to operate with a smaller, lighter footprint and much more agility in how we do things. You know, we've shown up in some places that people didn't expect us to show up in like B1s into India. You know, we could probably do a BTF in there someday. Some other places on the list of things to do. But what we're finding is that, you know, as you might imagine, when you put that cross-functional team of maintainers, support personnel, ops, people together, tight, small-knit group with a mission, and man, they just deliver every time because it's what they signed up for. So the BTF is intended to have layers of increments of capability that give us lots more options. But the deal I have with every air component is whatever I put there for however long it is, then I know exactly how to close on it with the rest of what they would need for conflict. So it's never done just in isolation. But what we are learning here is that a big contributor to the readiness of the crews. And when I think about it, there's really three key important parts. First, of course, is the presence in the theater, and that's been hugely successful. And that, you know, signals to the partners and allies. The impact on the would-be adversaries, we know exactly what this means to them, and it really bothers them. But probably what most people don't understand is the ability to really integrate from the command and control, the targeting, the communication, the ISR, you know, really refining how we would show up in someone else's theater and doing stuff in support of them. So you can't make that up on the fly, but every time we do a BTF, we get better and better at the long range kill chain and integrating from way out to help our teammates in each of the theaters.
No, I appreciate that. And you touched upon this, but how would you gauge, you know, our allies and our adversaries? How are they responding to this new concept? And when you've got a yardstick, how do you gauge the effectiveness of these task force missions?
Well, there's layers of that awareness. What we tried to do is make sure that it wasn't just an activity trap and that we really watch a lot of indicators. I won't go into it on this line, but we have a very good insight of what they mean. You know, you can make the case too, is that, you know, imitation is the highest form of flattery. And we're watching now the Russians try to do the same thing. They're just not quite as good at it. And so they're making those kinds of things happen. But our partners and allies get a lot out of this. The one that really comes to mind is when we went to Europe and we flew over every NATO country, you know, in a single day with the B-52s. And, you know, General Walter says, you have no idea the boost you guys gave this entire command, this entire alliance, by showing up and showing that commitment. But it begins to teach and show how we can push back in areas and how fast we can move in. And when we integrate our capabilities with fifth-gen capabilities and other things like that, it's a huge deal.
1 year later, could you explain how you've shifted gears from continuous bomber presence to the dynamic force employment model with the bomber task forces in the Pacific?
Well, Dave, the push was a little bit, it was an interesting story. We had to go brief. My aide calls it T-Ray's big day, because I had to go brief the chief, the secretary. I had to go brief the STRATCOM commander. I had to brief the chairman and the SecDef all in the single day to get through this. And so it was quite the gauntlet of briefings, but there's a little bit of a challenge by the chairman and the SecDef to deliver. And, you know, the message back was, you know, throw us in there because we're ready for this. Go ahead and test us. So getting them to believe that we could do it at that level was the first step. And as we watched it unfold, you know, the SecDef, then Secretary Esper was pretty cognizant of what we were saying from a readiness standpoint, how it helped us in the nuclear mission, but later how the crews and the maintenance teams were really, really enthusiastic. So we saw the greater engagement and the greater presence around the globe. We saw the boost to the team in lots of areas. So it was an easy thing from then on. And so what we really want to do now is just constantly take that bomber ace con op and just drive the TTP, the tactics, techniques, and procedures, and to really refine the logistical, the communications, and the weaponeering and art integration. So it really is now in a place where we are actually able to sit back and use our imagination with some of our teammates in the theaters. Well, if you did that, can you do this? Have you thought about this place? You know, and that's not just me to my teammates, but my teammates to me. Dave, we're having fun. We're actually having fun doing this. And that's at the 4-star level and at the crew dog level. So it's a great news story.
Sir, with the Force 140 bombers and a high demand signal, you obviously need to be careful with the aircraft and the crews that you have in inventory. Can you talk to us about these challenges and what it means to operate in such a high demand fashion with a low density force?
Well, we're not unlike a lot of parts of the Air Force when it comes to, you know, aging systems. And, you know, it just gets easier when the stuff is newer, more efficient, more effective, and when the funding is more stable. So I would put that on the table for my teammates in AMC, AATC, ACC, and certainly AFMC and PAC Avenue Safety. So, and AFSOC. But, you know, it is a testament to the amazing skill. We do think about how to go from a 3-bomber fleet to a 2-bomber fleet. We've got a solid plan. And back to an earlier question about pace, you know, what we could do for bomber task forces in FY20, we know we can do in 22 and beyond. We're going to surge a little this year, and then we'll reset. But as we divest some of the more tired B1s, because we don't have all the full-scale fatigue testing to give us a true sense of what we got to do in the long run. And there's some very expensive repair bills. We're playing this hand of cards about as well as we can play it. But to get to a pace that's more predictable and set and actually codified in the Global Force Management System. So we have a good idea how to do this. Of course, more money, new engines, you know, all that's going to make a big difference. And, of course, newer airplanes would be even easier.
So a bit of a follow-up, what does that suggest for the B-21 buy? Now, I know that's several years into the future, but what are your thoughts in that regard?
I'll tell you, the B-21 program, Dave, is incredibly healthy. There's something I want to highlight that's unique. Randy Walden and the RCO and Jason Voorhees, Colonel Jason Voorhees, the program manager, that unique relationship with RCO and a major command to go do things is actually incredibly effective, right? And then when you start thinking about Randy Walden leading the air battle management system, you know, or answer to JADC2, the connection with the B-21 to ABMS is total, right? It's not an add-on or an afterthought. It's part and parcel. But what we did is we came up with, since we have a modular design in the airplane, because it's a very mature technology compared to what you might think, far more mature technology, because it's open mission systems in its design and we own the tech baseline. We're able to be very, very steady on the requirements. And when you change requirements is when you get creep, but we've been able to do that. We've gone back and memorialized the process by which we'll connect our dots and our thoughts with the intel community, with labs, and with other programs and technologies, to where we can very rapidly bring new radios, new emitters, new weapons, those kinds of things very quickly to the airplane. It took me many years to get a JASM onto a B-2. I'm going to be able to do that in a year. So it's, when I say it's the B-21, it's not the B-2.1, right? It is a fundamentally different plane. But when we brief Congress on the process of how we're going to do that methodically and how we'll keep requirements stable and how we'll keep adding really fresh tech and sustaining the airplane in a way no one's thinking about, and we start talking about, you know, how we're doing stuff with bombers around the globe, then the power of that becomes pretty obvious. Have some great feedback from folks on the Hill about how we're doing that. So I'm pretty optimistic about the future of the B-21.
Sir, that's great to hear. You know, it's been decades since we've acquired a new bomber. Could you speak to us about some of the attributes you're looking forward to seeing in the B-21? I mean, you talked about the open architecture and some of the other elements, but what are other things on the table that are going to be important?
The things about, you know, where we are is, I go back to, this is the B-21, not the B-2.1. You know, in that whole process, we talked about my ability to design in a data-driven sustainment game plan that's not exquisite and unique like other programs, but that we can be really purposeful in the modernization efforts. That's got to be one of the key pieces. The fact that you're data-driven and you're digital is going to be a real key piece, how you can do tests, how you can do developmental and operational tests, a synthetic training environment, right? So we've started to work with some of the experts outside the Air Force who've been helpful to the Air Force on the Defense Science Board and Scientific Advisory Board on how best to create training systems of the future, right? So ATC's done some great things, but we're bringing in some more folks from the outside who are great at the human machine interface in those training environments. So we're going to build that environment from the beginning. We know that we're going to reduce the number of specialty codes inside the maintenance world. So we're going to go from a large number to a smaller, more generalized place. We have our maintenance guys right now embedded with the RCO to make sure we design in sustainability and simplicity and to really limit the number of things we have to do uniquely. So that is, you know, when you take an opportunity to be a different kind of team with this kind of capabilities, and it's really a match made in heaven with us and RCO.
T-Ray, we're now seeing a major surge by all the services to go after the long-range strike mission. Could you speak to why you think bombers present a unique value as compared to the other options under consideration? Unfortunately, they're not just under consideration. Some of the other services are moving out. And I think, you know, I have some strong opinions on this one. And I think it's time for DOD's leadership to exert some leadership just over what solutions are the most cost-effective and efficient. And it's certainly not surface-launched missiles that cost double-digit millions of dollars per shot.
Yeah, Dave, I read the release this morning. And you know, those in the Army have some very kind thoughts in the media. But in the end, I completely struggle with the reality check that's required here. I mean, I kind of get it in Europe. I kind of get it in CENTCOM, but I completely don't get it in the Pacific. I genuinely struggle with the credibility of that entire plan. I deeply struggle with the credibility of it. And we're doing it, Dave. I mean, if you like BTFs, then we're there. Imagine that with hypersonic weapons. The ability to be there in hours, not days, months, or weeks, or, you know, far more extended periods of time, and the ability to keep up that operational pace. So why in the world would we entertain a brutally expensive idea when we don't, as a department, have the money to go do that, when we've already proven this? So, you know, I've had a few congressmen ask me, and I think it's stupid. I just think it's a stupid idea to go invest that kind of money to recreate something that this service has mastered and we're doing already right now. Why in the world would you try that? So I try to make sure that my language isn't a little more colorful than it is, but give me a break.
No, thanks for that honesty. And you raise an extraordinary point. We are facing tight budgets as we move into the future. And so we really have to optimize our expenditures. And so it'll be interesting to see how that unfolds.
So we'll take a look here too. There's a few hypersonic events coming up, you know, with us. I won't go into all those details, but let's let the facts play out. When you've got bird in hand, proven capability, a team that knows what it's like, understands how to go do things around the globe so quickly, knows how to integrate the kill chains, I mean, why are you trying to recreate that unless there's a parochial interest?
Yep.
Sir, I appreciate those comments. Could you talk to us about some of the calculus that you use when you're talking to people about this decision, and how do we really cut to the notion of what provides better value, flexibility, et cetera?
Well, you can measure in a lot of ways, but, you know, just go ask your allies, hey, do you think the bombers can do this for us in 18 months, or are we willing to wait 5 years for the Army to perhaps do this and have to stage it, you know, over a month or two period of time to close to get to the theater? Do you actually think that that has a deterrent value? They'll probably give you the, I don't think so, right? Because there's a lot of countries who'd have to agree to this. I could see some of them probably agreeing in the European theater, maybe in the Central Asian theater, but I don't see it coming together with any credibility in the Pacific anytime real soon. So that's one measure, is what do your partners and allies really think? Two, you know, proving the CONOPS. I mean, yeah, we're doing it every day. We're doing BTFs, right? And it's not some huge change in how we would have to operate. So, you know, in the end, it's the connection to those air operations centers, the kill chains. I mean, I can prove to you this in a matter of months with real capability versus theoretical capability that's far more expensive. And it's going to require a fundamental different approach to basing, which, I mean, for some reason, we just skate right past that brutal reality check that some of those countries are never going to let you put their stuff like that in their theater.
Well, you know, I've been fighting this one my whole career, and that's that bombers often get beat up on the notion of being expensive. And folks, unfortunately, fail to consider just how many aircraft it would take to haul the kind of payload a single bomber can bring to the fight. If you just look at the B-2, carrying upwards of 80 JDAMs on a single mission, all independently targetable. Could you share your thoughts on how you help people understand cost per effect and the notion of value relative to simplistic measures of unit cost?
Dave, you do a good job of talking about, you know, impact per pound, per dollar, and that's a helpful piece. But I think some of the thinking out there just jumps right to this idea that we're going to just pick the conflict terms with a near-peer nuclear-armed adversary, and it's all about what we would classically call phase three. All their models go there. And if you have the luxury of just, you know, the time machine that will let you skate past all the bad events and win that one, and great. But it really is the other sides of that, right? So it's the ability for the nuclear piece to anchor the far right end of conflict with a nuclear-armed adversary. Right, so your ability to provide extended deterrence and nuclear options, it keeps the nuclear piece off the table. And that's where we continue to miss that reality, is that when you deal with a Russia, China, or North Korea, nukes are on the table and you've got to figure that out. You've got to be able to measure the worth of the bomber and its ability to play and deter in that. That's a very important price tag as the lines between nuclear and conventional theater conflict blur big time. So no O-plan in any theater works unless the nuclear stuff is laying flat, okay? There's that piece. And then there's the competition side that's left of it, right? When we wrote the Bomber Ace Conop, it talks about not just the conflict, but the competition side, to be there quickly, to deter, to send a signal, to be able to rapidly close firepower from very long distances without the same kind of challenges of basing and access that other resources are going to have. So you can take that narrow focus, and perhaps at the end of the Cold War, that's what we allowed ourselves. But Dave, that's not the world we live in anymore. We don't live in that world anymore. We live in a very dangerous place. And so if we just want to get down to that calculus, that's fine. But nobody can go do those things on those bookends when it starts talking about also delivering conventional capability. That's just my thought on that.
Sir, another area where we see confusion is the manned bomber's role in the nuclear deterrence mission, and you just alluded to it. But folks often ask that if we have ICBMs and ballistic missile submarines, why do we still need nuclear-equipped, you know, bombers? How do you answer that question?
On two dimensions, right? There are those out there who don't quite get all the the complementary attributes of the triad, the flexibility, the survivability, the responsiveness. And none of the things out there that we're doing that are an expression of national policy, let me just say that again, is clearly an expression of national policy of why we have a triad, because it's really how you have to do things. But when you start thinking about, the manned bomber's role, if you're interested in counterproliferation, then you're a fascinated individual when it comes to extended deterrence. The subs and ICBMs are phenomenal, but our South Korean teammates aren't going to derive the same kind of physical reassurance that we've got their back, or the Japanese or the Australians, right? So it becomes an important part of that. But when you start talking about older systems, you need to be able to manage the risk either from a technical or strategic reality. If any one of those things starts to falter, you need to pick it up another way. But it's also that very visible way to say to anybody that I'm getting ready to do something different, and I can very clearly message where you are on the escalation ladder. And then the last part, of course, is there's things we can do with a bomber, right? When you launch a bomber and execute it, right? When you execute an SLBM sortie, it's gone. When you launch an ICBM sortie, it's gone. There's no calling it back. Where you buy yourself as a national leadership team in a country hours of an opportunity to go get this right. So while it may not be as fast, it does have the ability for you to do something that is reversible, right? And then you can hold targets at risk that other people can't. That's how I see it. I hope that helps.
Yeah, thanks for that. I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up the notion of Joint All Domain Command and Control, or JADC2, and Advanced Battle Management System, ABMS. As I see it, penetrating bombers are going to play a major role in these approaches, because they'll bring sensors, computing power, connectivity with the broader force, as well as onboard kinetic firepower deep behind enemy lines where few others are going to be able to go. So in this context, aircraft like the B-21 could be a linchpin capability for JADC2 and ABMS as high-powered sensor shooter effector nodes. Could you walk us through your thoughts on this subject?
Well, Dave, without going to a higher level of classification, there's not a lot more I would add to your thoughts. I think what you said was incredibly comprehensive, but this is about being a competitor on the field and your ability to play multiple roles, right? And what you and I talked, what we just talked about earlier, is about the utility and the flexibility of the bomber. We now can do even more. And so much to your point, how we play that, it's not standoff or stand in. It's find a way to beat the stew out of the bad guys with whatever tools we have. And you can actually use a B-21 with a standoff weapon. So it becomes a question of, how you want to go put those things in play. But I think your thoughts are very well aligned with how I would articulate the opportunities.
No, thanks for that.
Sir, we all know budgets are getting tight. And as I see it, the Air Force can't afford to take additional risk in its bomber force. You're flying the oldest, smallest inventory the service has ever fielded, and demand is surging. So we need the B-21 and we need it in large numbers, but we also can't take additional risk by failing to modernize the bombers we'll have in the inventory for quite some time. How would you explain this to a member of Congress?
Well, the way we're actually having to explain it is with the bomber roadmap. And I think the bomber roadmap enjoys a great deal more credibility now after we've walked people through the things we had to do to make it real, like, weapons generation facilities, engines for the B-52, a test plan, a mod plan that made sense, walking away from certain things. But also I think includes adding external carriage to the B-1s, right? I think the bombers and the hypersonic weapon are a match made in heaven, ideal for that. And I think that there's a lot more we can do with both TAC boost glide and cruise missiles, air breathers. Both of those are really great matches for who we are and what we could do. And wherever we can, move something forward, not just for the bombers, but for the rest of the Air Force, then, sign us up for that. But it becomes, you know, a real balancing act with a B-52, with the engines, the cruise missile, the radar. We have a very good plan there, but it becomes one of keeping a pace with the comms and the connectivity and to go down those paths. I have a great deal of confidence with the B-21. That actually is, if you wanted to draw it up for accelerate, change, or lose, it would look like the B-21, you know, and how we would do that. You could overthink it, but it would take you years to come up with a better idea. So that piece right there, I think, is solid. Now we just work our way through the risk equation to the point where we get to a two-bomber fleet. And right now, that whole roadmap with all the details and the off-ramps are very well endorsed by Congress.
Well, General Ray, you've been incredibly generous with your time. And thanks so much for chatting with us today. These are some key points that need to get across to the public at large. And I'd also like to salute everything you and your team are doing to keep the mission going. You and they have a lot on their shoulders, and it's really important that we don't take what your men and women, your command, do for granted. So thanks again, and have a great aerospace power kind of day.
Thanks, Dave.
Sir, I'd like to add my thanks too. Much appreciated. With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to our guests for joining today's discussion. I'd also like to extend a big thank you to our listeners for your continued support and for tuning into today's show. If you like what you've heard today, don't forget to hit the like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment to let us know what you think about our show or areas that you'd like us to further explore. And as always, you can join in on the conversation by following Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn. You can always find us at MitchellAerospacePower.org. So until next time, this is Doug signing off.